Hello and welcome to the Library Cafe, a weekly program of table talk with scholars and librarians about books, ideas, and the formation and circulation of knowledge. Our guest today is James Carl Fisher, architect and architectural historian, who is here to discuss his exhibit entitled Suspension of Disbelief, Advertising, and Architectural Ethics on view in the Vassar College Art Library through November 30th. Welcome, James.
Hi, Tom.
First, I wonder, could you tell us about yourself and your work, since it's a bit out of the ordinary, and in fact, you would have been an interesting contestant on the old quiz show, What's My Line? I think a real stumper.
I think it changes almost every hour of the day, but there's consistency to it. Well, obviously I'm an architect and I was trained at RPI in upstate New York, but did most of my schooling in London at the Architectural Association. And I actually don't really see much of a difference between the architectural work that I do, the design work, and the history theory work, mainly because it's always a question of trying to understand how spaces can be thought and how those spaces extend out into, well, questions of, you know, what I want to do and what I should do is basically, you know, what characterizes the overriding concerns.
And you specifically work on zoo architecture?
I do. I fell in love with the London Zoo when I was there. It was 97 when I first got there. And for me, like, the zoo, it's just such a wonderfully complex beast in that so many issues come to a head in it. So I've tried to extend that out to my practice where I do some planning work, some lighting design, some exhibit design. But it's always a question, again, for me, of thinking how this space interacts with the way people think about the space.
Can you talk about any specific projects you've worked on as a zoological architect? Because I'm sure people would be interested.
Sure. Most recently, I did the master plan and several exhibits for the Turtleback Zoo in West Orange in New Jersey.
So do you look forward to the day when you can do penguin houses and baboons?
Absolutely. You know, I mean, I would love to. You know, it's coming.
So how did you become interested in the history of advertising and architecture?
Well, it was a long, complicated route, but I'd say, first off, my father was an ad man. He created the television department for BBDO, which was one of those big old Madison ad firms from, you know, very big in the 50s and 60s and 70s, and now it's part of Omnicom. So anyway, there's that segment, which I have to say, yeah, that's one reason why I got into it. Yeah. The other was, when I was looking at the ethics of architectural practices over the years, the issue of advertising always came to a head in that as something that was disdained. And in my own life, I knew that wasn't the case in general, that, you know, advertising was one of the first master's programs at Harvard, you know. And so there was this disconnect between what was being discussed professionally and what was being discussed in terms of society as a whole and the business as a whole.
Yeah.
So,
yes, interestingly, we're going to be interviewing Richard Lanham on the show next semester, whose book, I think it's called The Economics of Attention, is precisely on this subject, that information about stuff, including purely rhetorical information, is becoming a more important commodity than the material product itself. And yet there is this deep-seated ambivalence and even antipathy toward rhetoric and its commercial offspring, advertising.
It's a tricky thing. I know the GSD at Harvard itself, I mean, they run this theme, you know, I'd say every year for the last 100 years, you know, that somehow architecture is being commercialized.
Yeah.
But it's really not the case, you know, no more so than any other concern would be. You know, it's just, it's a convenient theme to lapse into because all the funding for an institution like that it's already in place.
Yeah.
And so it's sort of an easy fish in a barrel to take a pot shot at.
Now, your exhibition is an exhibit of advertisements mainly from various sources.
It's actually, there are two sets of chronologies in the exhibit. You know, on the one hand, there's the chronology of ethical codes from medicine and architecture mainly. But in the main, though, it's a history of architectural advertising and how that shifts when a professional ban on advertising comes in place. See, before 1909, you'll be hard-pressed to find a ban on advertising in any architectural code of ethics. They just don't exist. And in the main, too, it's difficult to find a separate code of ethics, a code of ethics separate from charters and bylaws. But even in those charters and bylaws, say of the RIBA, Royal Institute of British Architects, for example, you won't find any injunctions against advertising. But you do in the 20th century codes of ethics. In looking at architectural advertising, that's to say either the advertising of architects looking for work or the advertising of products that would include architects in them. But you only find those latter tout ads, that I'm calling them, after the ban on advertising comes in place. Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I'm trying to argue, that I argued in my dissertation and I'm arguing in the exhibit, is that the ban on advertising actually created a convenient way for architects to advertise without paying for it in the tout ad. And it borrows some from American medicine, this scheme, but it's very clear-cut. And architects, actually, the AIA, actually argues for this in the 1930s, that building manufacturers in their advertising should say, consult an architect, because it promotes the architect.
Yeah.
So
is the tout ad identical with the product placement ads we're so familiar with in the world of sports, where you have, say, an athlete like Michael Jordan endorsing Nike tennis shoes?
It's very similar to that.
Yeah.
It's very similar to that. It marks a problem in the supposed disinterest of the architect to specify different types of material.
Yeah.
So one of the arguments for professionalism is that the architect would have a certain degree of detachment from the manufacturer to select whatever product is the best for the job. But once you have the tout ad in place, there's a proprietary relationship that's established.
Yeah.
And so, but this is something that kind of discussion never really comes up. The advertising ban gets talked about in terms of a pre-existing dignity, which it's not. Like, there isn't a discussion of it before the actual discussion of a pre-existing dignity,
yeah,
if you know what I mean. So anyway.
So a lot of the exhibit is taken up with medical advertisements and the development of a almost parallel code of ethics in the medical profession, which helps to explain then what happens in architecture. And there is an influence, isn't there, between the two, especially going from medicine to architecture?
I think there's a borrowing. I think you can call it a borrowing. And in the form of codes of ethics themselves. See, you don't find codes of ethics, like detached documents that a group says, this is our code, you know, this is the ethics that we purport. You don't find that anywhere else but American medicine in the 19th century. In Britain, the British Medical Association actually rolls in their charters and bylaws, the regulations, the guidelines that doctors should follow. But the AMA actually makes this a public issue.
Uh-huh.
That, if I can put it this way, the AMA is advertising that they don't advertise. Whereas in Britain, if it's not done, which you can say that it is because you do find medical doctors advertising, but it's all internal. You know, all the discussion is internal. In America, though, it's a very vociferous proclamation. We don't advertise because we're professional. And it's very strange. That's a very strange disconnect.
And casting the net a bit wider, how do these regulations make their way into the legal professions?
There's discussion in legal ethics as well about advertising in the 19th century, but it's not formalized. The ABA doesn't have a code of ethics until the first decade of the 20th century as well. There's really a big transformation in American labor in the first decade of the 20th century.
At the same time,
it comes in across the board in that from a labor and a production economy, all of a sudden we have a service economy where obligations are claimed on the part of professionals, and they're assumed as well. You know, it's not necessarily a myth or a disingenuous move, but it is something that has this aspect of disavowal, you know, if I could use that as a concept.
There are some professions like the academic profession and certainly librarians where advertising doesn't even really come up. It's not our code of ethics, say. Yeah. But that's because it wouldn't, because we don't operate as independent business people the way architects and doctors can, I suppose.
I think that's very true.
Yeah.
Well, if anyone was interested, a listener, you could look on the Illinois Institute of Technology has a website where they list out it's over 500 different professions and all the codes of ethics that they have.
Oh, that's
they've gathered them together. What's amazing to me is how many of them, though, are similar. A lot of them are derivatives from medicine, but they carry the same advertising practices over, which is very strange because when you have a system of professions and a division of labor, one argument would say that each type of labor, you know, the reason why you license each one separately in terms of like New York State regulations, say, that is because each type of practice has its own requirements.
Yeah.
You know, there are things that say as a hairdresser that you need to do ethically speaking that would determine a very specific code of ethics.
Mm-hmm.
And if you were a plumber, you know, and you're a professional plumber, you know, because there is a professional plumbing code of ethics, it would have its own requirements. But what you find, though, is that all of these codes of ethics are very similar. The points in them don't deviate that much. And to me, that right away voids the notion that each one has its own separate criteria.
Mm-hmm.
And so it forces, as someone who's trying to think about the division of labor and as looking at architecture as one type of labor, it forces me to think about what that labor actually is and how is that related to the ethics. If I were a strict Marxist, right, I would say, well, this is all bunk. Because there's no such thing as a type of labor. There's labor or there's not. And any labor can be exploited. Any labor can be, you know, subject to the rules of accumulation and whatnot, you know, dependent on a certain mode of production, all that kind of sort of thing. But there's only one labor. And so a professional labor ethics on top of that, the only way you can describe it from a Marxist point of view is to say, well, that's a ruse. That's an ideological ruse for some concern. Now, in Marx, there really isn't a professional category. You know, profession as a concept doesn't really come up at that time. And it's slightly later. You start to see it in people like Carl Saunders Wilson in the 1930s. You know, really get talking about it. Anyway.
And in this respect, are we talking about an unwillingness on the part of people who consider themselves to be professionals to admit to being in the business of making money? And I wonder if there's an aristocratic association operative here, maybe, that...
That's the one thing, though, that I'm not so sure about, to be honest with
you.
The idea that there's an aristocratic, you know, a reluctance to make money, like the old obligations of the nobility, right?
An illusion.
An illusion, right? If you look down at advertising, who's advertising at different points in time? And I always look to advertising because, to me, you know, advertising is a willingness to accept that there's payment going back and forth. But you find the wealthiest people advertising all the time. You find no problem with the concept of being paid for the work provided. There isn't that break. With professionals, I think it does come in, I think, in terms of a difficulty with this concept of payment. And again, here, it's departing from looking at this economically and maybe looking at more psychosocially. But there's a difficulty with an exchange, either closing the exchange, or there's a difficulty in acknowledging an obligation in the exchange, or conversely, a willingness to set up an obligation in the exchange that doesn't close, so it could keep going. And even if I contradict myself when I'm talking here, it's a question of thinking these things through in terms of the obligations that is what we're talking about when we talk about ethics. In terms of the spread of this practice, bans on advertising are typically ascribed to Great Britain. You know, that there's a genteel economy that says, you know, an aristocratic, so we don't have, we're above that.
I was going to ask you about that.
It's actually not the case. And in the 1930s, the RIBA actually actively goes and takes the American Institute of Architects Code of Ethics and adopts its provisions. It rewords it. It makes it much more articulate and much more lengthy, I guess is a way to put it. But without really the driving force behind it. And they actually buy into the story of their history comes out of America.
So we sell it to them.
We sell it to them, and they buy in the fact that, well, of course we have this great, you know, grand ethical tradition, you know, of course. But that comes after the fact. It comes in medicine, too, with the BMA, but never quite with the force that it does in the States. But in the exhibit itself, though, I showed Tecton, the great British modernists, Berthold Lubetkin, and speaking of zoos, you know, designing the London, the London Zoo and the Manchester and the Dudley Zoo projects, you know, he's actually featured in a few ads for concrete. And to me, that's wonderful because there wasn't a more avowed Marxist on the planet than Berthold Lubetkin. And here you have him in an ad for touting concrete. You know? So this is a general systematic process. There's no culpability in any of this, but it is something that, you know, it has a flow to it that needs to be interrupted. And so,
interesting. So anyway, these ethical codes that we see through most of the 20th century, they've taken a big hit in the last decade or so, haven't they, with Supreme Court decisions about bans on advertising?
Yeah, I often like to say, thank God for the Supreme Court, you know, as an architect. But it's not all rosy. Let me say this like straight out. Over the 20th century, more architects were either censured, suspended, or expelled from the AIA for advertising than for any other issue. Incompetence, none of that plays a role. It's only for the perception of paying for advertising, which, you know, in looking at the exhibit, you say, well, what exactly is being protected? You know? But anyway, in medicine and law, the ban on advertising actually increased exponentially going into the 40s and 50s. In the 50s, there was a lot of debate. And then in the 60s, it was accepted status quo, professionals don't advertise, you know, across the board. The Supreme Court actually got involved in the 1970s. There was a law firm, it happens in a number of cases, but the most prominent actually was a case called Bates versus the state of Arizona, where a law firm wanted to advertise because they wanted to reach the poorer populations in the community. They weren't able to do this through the normal channels, the bar, so they advertised. The bar sued them. That case went all the way to the Supreme Court, And in that, the bar and the other professional associations joined hands pretty much to argue the need for a ban on advertising to protect the public because they were ignorant. They couldn't understand what these different professions were doing. The court essentially checked off each of the professional concerns as ludicrous, one by one by one, and actually argued that by banning advertising, the professional societies were actually promoting in-person solicitation, which is much more susceptible to fraud and coercion. Because if you think with lawyers in particular, a lawyer is trained in how to argue a case and convince people that they're right.
They're right? A perfect salesman.
That's right. So doing this in person is much more ethically suspect than broadcast advertising.
Yeah.
So in 1977, on the heels of this case, there were other cases involved too, and the Judiciary Department got involved. But essentially, though, codes of ethics were tossed by the wayside. Mm-hmm. This lasted for about 7 years. By the end of the 1980s, though, you started to see these same provisions appear in local state board regulations. So the Regents, for example, in New York, picked up much of what was in the AIA's old code, namely the ban on advertising. But now it's dispersed through a number of different policies that, you know, now we talk about as an architect, if I am registered in New York, say, and I am, if my advertisement were to somehow appear in New Jersey, where I live but where I'm not registered, I would be liable to prosecution. A case like this actually happened out west, where it was on an architect's website that they listed themselves as an architect in the state of, I believe it was in Oregon, and I believe it was in California that the ad showed up. I could be wrong on that. But the point of the matter, though, here is that the architect was prosecuted and lost. It lost the case. It essentially what amounts to a violation of the ban on advertising because the word got out that, you know, the term architect was used, even though licensed in one jurisdiction, not licensed in another. And so a ban on advertising is effectively set up because you can't restrict the flow of advertising to one state or another.
No, not with the internet anymore.
No, absolutely.
Or even print publication, right?
So, That's right. So it comes back to a question of advertising. And I actually defy anyone to define what an architectural quack might be. You know, I've heard people use this. I've heard the dean of the Minnesota School of Architecture, very prominent fellow, you know. I heard him actually argue this in a lecture that in the 19th century there were architectural quacks running around. And I'm sitting there thinking, and I'm licensed, I've got my PhD, I've done more things with the IA than most.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, what the heck could an architectural quack do, you know, that would endanger the public? We have engineers to check up, you know, that buildings will stand up, not leak, those kind of things. We have building codes to check on fire safety. All these levels. Now, I'm not saying that architects are not valuable, because I think they are, but I think they're mainly valuable in that, you know, they can come to a situation they know nothing about and give a fresh perspective. Anyway, that's to get off the topic, maybe, but the idea of the matter, though, these laws on advertising, though, found their way back into regulation, but they did it in a very, well, I should say a very hidden way. And it's actually, the situation's more, I'd say, dangerous for an architect now, because now they're state laws, and they're not society guidelines. You know, before, I would be thrown out of the AIA if I were, well, let's stick with the advertising. If I did an incredibly gauche ad, I'd be thrown out of the AI.
But you could still practice architecture.
Right. Yeah. But now I couldn't.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Or I'd have to market myself as a designer, you know, and find an architect, a licensed architect to partner with.
Well, in terms of medical advertising, the idea of quackery plays a big part in the development of the profession, especially in the 19th century, doesn't it? And the exhibit features many ads for patent medicines making exaggerated claims for their effectiveness. And there's a very interesting Collier's Magazine item declaiming the involvement of the publishing industry in patent medicine swindles and scams in their advertising. No less interesting because the item is itself an ad that depicts these other ads. And, of course, pharmaceutical advertising is back on the boards in a big way. You can't turn on the TV without being overwhelmed with ads for modern-day patent medicine. In fact, they must surpass even automobile advertising in their ubiquity.
I can see one point that could come out of that. You would say, well, pharmaceutical concerns ought to be regulated, right? Which we'd all say, I think we'd all agree. That would be lunacy not to, right? The question, though, is what's the role of a medical doctor in that regulation? And this can be very tricky because you can start to sound a little reclusive here, you know, if you attack medical doctors in this way. But if we were to trace the history, say, of pharmaceutical advertising, it's actually a very interesting topic and related to the ban on advertising as well. The first ban on advertising that you'll find anywhere comes out of the New York State Medical Society in 1821. And it's actually tied in to a campaign to expose the composition of so-called nostrums. You know, these nostrums were thought to be placebos. You know, in the main, they don't have anything in them other than, you know, maybe some mercurius calamide or maybe some bark of this or that in it. But in the main, though, it's the faith that the consumer puts in the medicine that gives it its healing power. That's the way they word it in the 1820s, mm-hmm. the New York State Medical Society. That's the way it's worded. Now, to me, that's fascinating because what it's saying, you know, to think about that for a second, it's saying that we want to take away this curative power because the medicine is working. People believe in it. The medicine is working, but they're not going to doctors, right? To build up medical knowledge, to make sure the faculty is what it should be, you know, in charge of medicine. Mm-hmm. This division should be here of a certain type of medical practice, you know, not homeopathy, not, we should, if we go by Benjamin Rush, we should be getting out the lancets and bleeding, you know.
Yeah.
But that's the heroic forms of medical practice that these cures, legitimate cures, are preventing. And so something has to happen. So first it starts in the 1820s where the composition of these nostrums is published.
Mm-hmm.
Now, a similar publishing campaign comes out later on, and the Collier's ad is actually a compilation of those kinds of advertising attacks, mm-hmm. you could almost say, to get rid of these cures. Because they're unhelpful, you know, they're thought to be unhelpful overall.
Well, many of them are perfectly ordinary products and long-lasting products, I should say. Ivory soap, for instance, for which over-the-counter health claims are being made, which draws attention to the amorphousness of the concept of health itself, I suppose. I especially like the ad recommending Welch's grape juice as a curative for typhoid fever.
In the exhibit itself, there are a few that I loved. I mean, the Valentine's meat juice.
Yeah.
You know, there's a meat juice ad that, I should say, in the exhibit, all of the ads that I selected were actually out of the AMA's journal.
Oh, that's interesting.
They're all out of the AMA's journal itself because I wanted to show, well, one, that there's always this relationship between industry and this professional layer. You could almost look at the AMA and doctors, and you know, this again, this is with a grain of salt. You could almost say that doctors become the middlemen for the pharmaceutical industry. Yeah. It doesn't matter what's said, you know, layering on top of this. And this gets to the point of what you do as an historian, I think. But it's almost as if you can think of what they say about prestige, which doesn't exist before, all of these things about quacks and pharmaceuticals and nostrums. You could almost throw it out the window and look at the pharmaceuticals saying, all of a sudden, we don't just have salesmen or salespeople, or salesmen at this time, because it's, you know, it's very misogynistic. We don't have just salesmen. We have salesmen with an intimate relationship to the consumer. And so all of a sudden, it's a hard word to say, well, doctors become shills.
Yeah.
But often when we write these histories, we look from within and we say, well, the AMA is such a powerful professional organization. The 20th century is, you know, the century of the AMA. Yeah. But you could almost look at them as a surface layer for all of these industrial things going on behind it, regardless of the claims made. It's tricky because for myself as an American, I've grown up in a different understanding. Anyway, but one of the things the exhibit tries to speak about in putting things out like the meat juice or like the ivory soap or even all of the cabinets and all of the products, you know, that the AMA has, cigarettes, you know, more doctors smoke camels than any other cigarette, you know. All of those things come out on the surface of these industrial relations below it. And I said before, I'm not necessarily Marxist because at a certain point, you know, there are difficulties in that position, but it's almost impossible not to think about these relations that way.
Yeah. You know? Yeah, it is interesting, and especially now that drug companies are advertising everywhere, and it seems even more so than it used to be.
But I think you could almost say that, and you know, doctors inside their own discussions in the AMA journal, there's almost a sense that the doctors can be irrelevant in a certain way because, well, let's put it this way. If I'm a pharmaceutical company and I want someone to use my product, if I have to advertise to the doctors first and then get them to advertise to their patients, which is essentially what prescribing is.
Yeah.
It's sort of a limited advertising. Do you want to do this or don't you?
Yeah.
To get to that point, if it's cheaper to just cut out the doctor as irrelevant, well, then there's no reason why they wouldn't. They're regulated by the FDA, or they should be much more so. Now, I'm not arguing that we don't need doctors. I'm slightly hypochondriac myself. But the idea, though, conceptually, though, thinking about these things, there's no reason why, as a pharmaceutical, I believe in my product, say, speaking as a pharmaceutical, I believe in my product. I think it's safe. I've done my clinical trials.
Yeah.
We need to make some money so we can go back and do more R&D. And so there are all sorts of, you can call it justification, but what's the logic that's driving this force?
Yeah, interesting. Back to architectural ethics and the advertising bans. On the positive side of the ethical code, architects, as you said, didn't have to pay for advertising. It was done by others, corporations. And also, it does present them as objective in a certain way. And they can also borrow from the medical profession and this kind of heroic identity that comes with this. But on the downside, you mentioned so many architects were thrown out of the AIA for advertising. Are there other negatives in terms of the effect of the ban on the practice of architecture itself?
Oh, I think so. It comes back to thinking of advertising as a commodity. You know, that this is something that it's a profession itself. And I said this, you know, going back to my thinking of my father as an advertiser, you know, I always rebelled against this growing up. But advertising is a very valuable commodity. The old slogan is, I know only 50% of my advertising is effective. I just don't know which 50% that is, right? So even if it's a scattershot, but you still have to rely on that 50% that's successful. What architects do in the scheme, or what happened, I think, to architects in this scheme, is that it's a compensation to have someone pay for your advertising. You think you're saving money. You think, as an architect, look, it's too expensive. I can't afford the service of an advertiser. Someone else should do it for me. But that takes the control over what you're saying out of your hands. And so no longer can you advertise different modes of practice. No longer can you say, this is why I'm different from that architect. Mm-hmm. And it's not a matter of collegiality here, I don't think. I mean, it's not necessarily that. It's more of a dysfunctional practice that got adapted as a short gain, you know, short-term gain as opposed to a long-term gain. Architecture, I chair a committee for the AIA in New York, so I'm very pro-architect. I have to say that. I think it has an incredible amount of value to a project. So taking that first, what I'm saying here, though, is that, you know, there are many different types of practice as an architect, right, that you can get into that may not be the same as another architect, another collegial architect in this body. Lots of different things. You could work with fashion. You could work with light. You can work with real estate. And you could work with young architects, exciting new materials. Yeah. You can think a whole range of problems.
Yeah, and the codes do kind of homogenize you all then.
It does. Yeah. It's the codes, but it's really driven by architects themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't come from without. And this is tricky because it takes away any notion of a project. You know, that you would do this because somehow it will get you ahead in society as a group.
Yeah.
I'm arguing that these are dysfunctional practices. There isn't a rhyme or reason to it. It's more a question of how badly people think and behave when they get together. There's a literature, and I know, you know, I talk a lot about psychoanalysis in my work. It's not that I want to be dogmatic and saying, Freud's my guy and I'm going this way. It's not that. It's that some of the writings and the subsequent writings after that in group psychology allow you to think of how dysfunction can happen. Mm-hmm. The sociology of the professions is actually very clear-cut, I think. After you have that round of sort of the, you know, we almost call them like original historians of the profession, like Carr Saunders Wilson, they write as if the AIA is writing its own history.
Yeah.
After you have that kind of thing, you have a set of critical historians who comes. The best of these is Magali Safadi Larson. Wonderful set of books. And of course, I disagree with some of the things she says, but it's really one of the best books around. She argues that there's a social project, that these groups operate as if they're striving for cultural capital by doing all of these obscure, what she calls anti-market principles, things like not advertising.
Yeah,
you know,
that's interesting.
And you know, she argues that it's essentially, she doesn't close the argument at any point in the books, which is why I have concerns. Mm-hmm. But the idea though is that this is a project. Now, what I would say on the other hand, moving forward, I say, well, no, it's not a project. It's actually dysfunction. It's actually a group that might have done much better, you know, not to have advertised. And again, this is coming out of analysis. I mean, I talk about ethics quite a bit, but you know, the famous quote that kind of circulates the rounds is you say, well, yes, there's a problem with ethics and architecture today. The problem is there's too much. You know, there's too much. It's restricting what people can do without helping, without achieving the claims of service it sets out to. So.
In this psychoanalytic approach or reading, you identify the earning of money with sexuality here, right? In your reading of the ads or?
Actually, what I've tried to do is restrict my reading to this idea of groups themselves.
Uh-huh.
I know that sexuality does come out quite a bit in the presentation of the ads.
Yeah.
There it's a question more of identifications within advertising as a medium rather than looking at the money and sex that would go together, say, in that kind of arena. Yeah. What I look at with analysis is saying, well, look, I focus in on groups, you know, the AMA, the AIA, you know, the ABA, even the antebellum medical societies. But I look at them in groups to say, well, they're making these very odd claims. You know, I'm proclaiming that I don't speak. I'm advertising that I don't advertise.
Yeah.
And so I'm describing that as disavowal because I want to avoid this idea that it's an ideological ruse to get ahead. But I also want to show that even in their best moments, right, groups are regressive entities. And they're regressive in the sense that they'll go back to very short-term gains, you know, to move ahead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if we talk about, say, like, well, with money, whenever you talk about money in Freud or in analysis, you talk, well, yeah, we talk about money. We talk about, well, it's obviously feces. Mm-hmm. And it's obviously, you know, there's a question of defiance. You know, when the baby, you know, in Freud you say the baby's first act of defiance is, I'm not going to go now. It's a marker in development.
Yeah.
It's almost as if, you know, you could read that. And I don't do this in the exhibit, and maybe sensibly, but I don't do this in the exhibit. But you could almost take that notion of irrational defiance and look at the code of ethics that way, that this is a moment of irrational defiance that happens to have been institutionalized.
Yeah.
These are regulations. There's another wonderful book by Terry Johnson, who used to teach at University College of London across Freud, where I did my work. I did a wonderful book that basically said, well, if you're going to look at what a profession is, because nobody had really been able to define this closely for 100, you know, 100 some odd years, you know, that it's always a very loose concept. So if you're going to look at what it is, you have to say, well, a profession is the regulation of the profession. There's nothing that exists that isn't in that regulation. So that's when I read that, and I said, that's what I'm going to let me look to that regulation. But even this regulation, though, is tinged with all these complex levels of affect. So, I mean, that to me is, it's wonderful in the sense that it makes this, you know, it's sort of the anti-Kafka. You know, you look at these things and they actually have a breath of life, as awful as that can be, you know, scattered across them. But they have that aspect to it. But it means, though, that they almost have to be taken with a grain of salt when you look at regulations. And thinking that, well, if I'm trying to do a productive project as an architect, or I'm trying to rethink my work as an architect, I have to do away with all of that, you know, because I know it's almost that's someone else's baggage. And, you know, I come to this, I don't know, we've talked about this privately off air, but, I started off as a physicist and looking at light and optics, and then I landed in architecture, and then I landed out of architecture and back in lighting, and, you know, then I was in landscape for a while, and you can't do those things if you take an institutional or institutionalized view of it, you know, meaning that in the dysfunctional sense of the word.
Yeah.
You know, it's always got to be a question of mixing and matching and plugging things in and out where you can.
So what is the anxiety that drives the desire to formulate these codes instead of repressive codes? We heard a recording last week of an interview with Norman Mailer, who passed away the weekend before. And he offered this description of America as having a collective guilty conscience over the incompatibility of our behavior when it comes to making money with our religiosity. With dog-eat-dog capitalism on the one side and the Sermon on the Mount on the other, that results in a kind of collective self-loathing as well as a unique fear of judgment. Do you think there's anything to that?
No. I have to say this. I mean, I have my own religious sin, which isn't necessary to get into, but I never met a Christian yet who wasn't willing to save. You know, what's the old line, you know? You know, Christ saves, but Moses invests, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, I say that, you know, thinking that, you know, I don't think you can make those kind of qualifications on life.
Well, it's a big statement. Yeah.
It's a big statement, and I think it's actually caught up. What I would look at, you know, to bring something to the table, I would actually look at all of the attacks on the profession or on architects, both individual and collectively. So, and by that I mean the American Institution of Architects actually is a precursor to the AIA. The architects of the time, and we're talking about people like Robert Mills, Thomas Walters, Ustik Walter, you know, designer of the Capitol, you know, even William Strickland, absolutely hated each other. Absolutely, always at their necks. But the one thing that bound them were criticisms that they couldn't handle money, that they wasted clients' money. And if you look at actually all of the architects that are cited in later literature as being architects, all went bankrupt. They all went bankrupt. And usually it's thrown off to hardship. It's thrown off to all sorts of different things in the antebellum years.
Yeah, and that was the usual course for all business people in those years just about, though, isn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think it is. But there are practitioners who are designing and building who actually do quite well. You know, they invest and they move on. And they're usually labeled as mechanics by later architects.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, I mention that because the ethics that's drafted up at the end of the 19th century really flips those claims around where, I as the architect have been, say this like subconsciously, mm-hmm. I as the architect have been accused of spending too much money. It can't be me. It must be someone else. Let's look at the clients. Clients don't know how to spend their money. They need an architect to do it for them. Mm-hmm. That's the underlying logic of why you would have an architect designing your project. An architect is telling you, you don't know what you're doing. You're not an architect. It's sort of the professional mantra in general. Yeah. You don't know what you're doing. Yeah. I should be doing that.
Yeah.
And it always comes out after that that I'm going to save you money. I'm going to be efficient in your money. I am going to work your money to its best advantage. Yeah. When really, those are the attacks saying that's exactly what an architect can't do. And that preceded, if you want to call it the era of architectural ethics in the States. So it's these inversions. That's why Freud is so useful, because you can look at these relations, underlying relations of identification, and show how they flipped. It's similar in medicine, too, where if you find doctors advertising that they don't advertise, they're really assuming quack practices. And you'll find that they do maintain, after attacking the notion that Nostrum peddlers advertise, right? They start advertising the fact they don't advertise, but they also start advertising the fact that they have confidentiality, that they don't speak. So it's this complex, like these flips that you, very fun to trace as an historian, because you get in there and you say, tell me something that makes sense. Yeah. But it's fun when you don't get it, actually. Yeah.
So the bans on advertising applied, certainly in the beginning, mainly on print advertising. I mean, this is before the age of radio and TV, but radio and TV come in. But that type of advertising is, to some extent, based on print advertising. There were ways that architects have always promoted their work without that kind of advertising. I mean, they put signs up in front of projects saying, constructed by such and such architectural firm. They show up at trade shows. They show up at home building exhibits. So is there something peculiar about print culture especially?
There's actually a direct relationship between those kind of things and the ban on advertising.
Is there?
There is. In the 1930s, there's a sequence of articles in the Architectural Record, and actually one of these is featured as a panel in the exhibit, where if architects can't pay for advertising, they have to find substitutes. Again, we're back in Freud. Yeah. But you have to find substitutes. And the substitutes come out just that, trade shows, going on TV, going on radio, but always promoting the profession as a whole is the theme throughout this. Running education classes, continuing education for the public, art shows. All of these things come out, and this isn't me spouting something new. This is in the ads in the 30s and in the AIA's own public documents at the time. This is what an architect should do to promote architecture as a generic concept, which essentially means the business and practice of individual architects working in collaboration. If there's anything to stress in all of this, is that there is no grand architecture that's getting paid. There's a business transaction at the heart of architectural design and service. And it's not saying it's the be-all, end-all of what you can do, but it's critical, to recognize that.
Yeah.
So anyway, but all of these other things, to stick to the point, all of these other advertising vehicles, marketing vehicles, all stem back to this one injunction that says an architect cannot pay for advertising. That's the start of all of it. Especially, and I go back to Harvard too, because it troubled me to see the last conference on this again.
We mentioned the place most people see something akin to a tout ad anyway is the product endorsement by sports figures and professional sports figures, but also amateur sports figures, which makes me ask, the way in the world of sports, professionals and amateurs are separated from one another, it seems to be the converse of what we're talking about here to some extent, isn't it? And that in professional sports, it's professionals who get paid, and they work for money, basically. They're lots of money oftentimes. Whereas it's the amateurs, the Olympians, presumably, who don't work for money, and then who really do have to fall back on product endorsements and tout ads. Though that's changed too, I know, and to some extent, not entirely. It's become more complicated, same as with architects. So, what do you make of that? Is it just a matter of semantics?
I think part of it is a question of semantics in the word profession.
Yeah.
But I think also the question comes up in a distinction between licensed architects, right? So to stick to architecture, between licensed architects and the canonical figures labeled as architects, because most of them weren't licensed in the States. You look at Mies is not licensed. Corbusier is not licensed. And so you can run through the recent troubles at the World Trade Center. Daniel Libeskind, not licensed in New York. Yes, they took care of that over time. But they partnered him up with a local firm, to get this through, SOM, or licensed locally. And so there is that distinction. And I think if there's a division between professional and amateur in sports, I think it would relate in architecture to the difference between, well, a licensed architect, a local architect, mm-hmm. if you will, yeah. and a design architect yeah. that's now championed as they call them Starkitecture in you know the HEP magazines.
Interesting, yeah.
So I think that's the difference. Yeah.
They're relying to a great extent on this cult of celebrity, though, that you talk about in the exhibit, the Starkitects.
I think in part, you know, a lot of them have quite a bit to say, and which, to be honest, a lot of licensed architects don't. You know, well, maybe they do, but they have to do it in a different way. Let's put it that way, because, yeah. like I said, there's always a value to everything.
Yeah, David Childs would argue with you, probably.
No, of course, yeah. of course. so, no, but see, yeah, but I respect what they do, yeah, but it's a yeah. different kind of engagement, and it's split off. So, but someone like Zaha Hadid, absolutely brilliant designer. You know, but would I trust that firm to get a project through the New York City Buildings Department? Absolutely not.
Yeah.
You know, so it's a question of expertise.
Now we have some interesting examples of ads in the show that trace the history of advertising in the professions of medicine and architecture. So let's start with some examples of medical advertising. Can you talk about these a bit?
I mean, the only thing I would say regarding the medical ads, I actually split the ads up into four sections.
Mm-hmm.
One stream actually looks at advertisement that asks people to go to sanitariums. So that actually relates architectural practice and medicine in a very odd way, in that you have architects illustrating these locations mm-hmm. that are designed for health. Health and architecture is a huge theme of the 20th century and modernism, that somehow by designing a building in a certain way, mm-hmm. it will cure people of tuberculosis and all sorts of other ailments. The cleanliness tagline, you know, if you want. But in the 19th century, you actually see that first in terms of these sanitariums, these locations that are designed as places to be healthy.
Mm-hmm.
That's one set of the ads. The other is products, you know, things like Welch's grape juice, Ivory soap. We had the Valentin's meat juice, which I can't yeah. say enough, you know. And there's that level of product that, you know, so-and-so doctor recommends this product for you at home. There's that. Similac babies are better babies, you know, those kind of things. The next layer of advertisement were devices,
mm-hmm.
you know, where they're actually being marketed to doctors to use on their patients.
Yeah.
So you'll have cabinets in the 1880s designed to, you know, steam cabinets, you know, basically do an old Greco-Roman purge on someone. You'll have those kind of things, or you'll have braces, and, you know, any number of exercise equipment as well. And then you'll also have, at the end, techniques and therapies, which are a little different than the devices in that it basically defines medical practice for the doctor in the kinds of medications to apply and when. So those four aspects are in there.
Yeah, interesting. And with the architectural advertisements, you have one of the original tout ads by the founders of the AIA.
This actually, I smile every time I think about it. James Renwick and Richard Hunt, you know, scouring through the magazines trying to find advertisements with architects. Before the 1880s, you'll find architects advertising everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
You'll find them in directories. You'll find them in newspapers. You'll find them in trade books. You'll find their own books being published as ads, mm-hmm. you know, to openly foster business. 1887, we find this wonderful Lincrusta Walton, which is a plasterboard, very strong plaster material, being promoted by James Renwick and Richard Mars Hunt.
Mm-hmm.
That's fascinating because they're founders of the AIA, and they're always written of as the gentry of professionalism. Hunt, in particular, bringing back a specific type of practice from France, you know, of the academy to America, that's raising the status up. And here they're in a tout ad saying, "I find Lincrusta Walton to be, you know, dot dot dot, the, you know, the best product ever," you know. And it started, their firms actually after that, and derivatives of their firms, do the same thing for the next, you know, 40 years. And so that's one of the hallmarks, to look at that and say, there's something going on. There's something going on when the tout ad is introduced to architecture by the gentry of the AIA. There's some relationship there.
Yeah.
So there's that piece, and then after that you'll find photography added into the mix. Well, line sketches first, the drawings. The drawings actually are fun because they're actually advertising stain products, Cabot stain, Dexter mm-hmm. Brothers stain, things you can't show in a line drawing. And so it takes away the notion that no longer are architects illustrating something. They're there for another reason. And if you were very skeptical, you say they're there because they've gone to the building manufacturer and say, "Look, you put me in your ad or I will no longer specify Cabot stains. I will specify Benjamin Blank Moore, right? I'll do this instead. Yeah. So there's a bit of an ethical problem there, yeah. A little bit of a stranglehold.
Are there contracts ever here? Do you think signed contracts where somebody like Frank Lloyd Wright might be required to use a certain kind of concrete the next time he does a building if he...
I don't think so.
No.
I haven't found anything like that.
Yeah.
But then again, that's one of the beauties, I think. One of the fun parts about this exhibit is that it's an open... Because obviously I speak about professions and advertising and ethics in a different way than most people. But each of these practices... Like if someone... I know there are... 1,000 dissertations written this year on Frank Lloyd Wright across the country.
Yeah.
It would be wonderful, obviously, if someone would look into those kind of relations.
Yeah.
What's the relation of Frank Lloyd Wright's studio to industry?
Yeah, hot water heating, the companies that appear in the ads. You have quite a number of Frank Lloyd Wright ads in the exhibit, I noticed. And to some extent, they seem, when I look at them, they undermine what Frank Lloyd Wright was trying to do with his persona in that, he's associated with these kind of banal systems that are in his buildings or curtain manufacturers that manufacture fabrics for the insides.
Well, that's a terrific point. I think basically whatever he was doing worked. Because I know these ads are starting to appear in presentations
now. So do you think this is part of what made Frank Lloyd Wright Frank Lloyd Wright, his use of this kind of medium?
I think yes, but I think filtered. Mm-hmm. I think Frank Lloyd Wright would have done better had he had a publicist. I think he did okay, But I think
he was a good
self-publicist. I think he did okay, right? Well, I was saying financially. But I guess the reason I pulled so many Frank Lloyd Wright pieces out was in the main because, just like you say, it's so shocking to see Thrush hot water heat in falling water. Whoever talks about that,
I know.
Right?
Yeah.
But he's not alone. I should say I do more akin for a certain kind of celebrity.
Yeah.
But prosaic architects occupy similar... There are certain architects have runs in the ads.
Yeah.
They manage to get into the stream of doing things.
Yeah.
They're not all famous. And so as for an exhibit, it's hard to make it interesting to people to point to the non-famous folk at this point.
And then Walt Disney features in some of the ads where you talk about the development of the cult of celebrity through the tout ad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Walt Disney, it's a strange category. There are four ads in particular that always come to mind. There's one that markets GE Electricity in the home of Mickey Mouse.
Yeah.
And it shows Walt Disney's house from the 30s. Yeah. It's wonderful, but it's Mickey Mouse's house.
Yeah.
It's not real.
He lives
with
Walt
Disney.
No, it's
not real. That's right. He lives with Walt Disney. Well, one that comes after that, though, that I absolutely love, it's a carpet ad from the 1970s. And it shows the Contemporary Hotel and, with all the trademarks and, but it shows it for Acrolan carpet.
Mm-hmm.
And in the corner of the ad is a little copyright symbol, copyright Walt Disney Enterprises. That's actually a wonderful little detail because in none of these other ads in the exhibit will you find a copyright symbol. Mm-hmm. And I said, wait a minute, all this work, all these architectural drawings, there are drawings, there are photographs, mm-hmm. all these, not a single copyright symbol other than Walt Disney. And I said, well, what's going on here? And I found out that architects didn't copyright their drawings. And I said, well, why? And I looked in the 1920s, and I'm looking through all of the literature trying to find this, and it turns out the architects in the 1920s actually argued that if we copyright our drawings, if we take this legal protection, mm-hmm. they won't be able to circulate as advertising. And so for 70 years, essentially, architectural drawings went unprotected because of this convoluted scheme to not pay for advertising but advertise anyway. And it's all in that little copyright sign.
Mm-hmm.
So Disney, to me, comes out in this as the architect who advertises. Because I look at Disney and I see architect.
Yeah.
I don't have that distinction anymore.
No, he wasn't a member of the AIA, but certainly had an influence on the way American buildings looked in the latter part of the 20th century, didn't he?
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. You look at the City of Tomorrow videos, that movie that Disney is wonderful. They keep reintroducing this old stuff. But you look at the kinds of things that are talked about, whether it's nature programming or tomorrow, the cleanliness that, I don't want to give him, it's a company.
Yeah.
I don't want to give the company more credence than it deserves, but because obviously you have the whole European modern movement there, but the way that it's done in American society in the 50s and 60s by Disney has an enormous impact on how buildings are designed and how environments are thought. Even if it's a question of not looking at something, I know for anyone to wander around outside of the parks in Anaheim or Orlando, you walk in the neighborhoods immediately adjacent, they're not quite what you get on the inside. And that blindness is built into that mode of thinking, or that mode of that space. I always call these things spaces as being an architect. There's a blindness built into the landscape that you just kind of live with, whether you're an historian. And it's not a bad thing. This doesn't highlight Disney as an evil player or anything like that. In fact, quite the opposite. is more of a typical player.
Yeah.
In any event, they're in the exhibit because, to me, it typifies quite a bit.
And then Bob Hope appears in a couple of these in this section on celebrity.
Well, part of that's accidental. It's accidental because I lectured on this in Pittsburgh.
Uh-huh.
And of all the places to be lecturing, I was lecturing in the Bob and Dolores Hope Room in Pittsburgh. And, you know, if you can play Pittsburgh, right?
Yeah.
But the ads, the ones that I pulled out, I thought they were quite nice because, one, they spoke to children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Bob Hope's children appear in these ads.
Yeah.
And there's no problem in seeing, like, the acting profession, right? You know, the grand profession. There's no problem seeing that field advertising, however elegant or debased it might seem.
No, yeah.
You know, that fits right into this venue.
Yeah, we're all used to seeing Lauren Bacall, advertising her first in the New York Times Magazine now.
So, that's right.
Yeah.
Again, here, it's speaking in sort of an off way to the sort of 70s and 80s sociology that looks at projects.
So I used to feel, I have to say, watching Bing Crosby do his orange juice commercial. But whatever happened to poor old Bing Crosby? He's got to do orange juice commercials.
Well, I know they get paid really well. Which is not bad.
I wanted to talk about the two ads we used for posters to promote the exhibit and your lecture last week. One is the ad for Lord Calvert Whiskey, which depicts a dapper young architect, I think it's John C. Lindsay, holding a glass of whiskey, and there are architectural models arrayed across the background. And the caption reads, "The Whiskey of Distinction for Men of Distinction." And I have to say, I thought immediately when I saw it of the same kind of spot that Bill Murray's character does for Japanese television in the movie Lost in Translation. I don't know if you saw that, but, you know, there's a spot where he's holding up the little guy.
Well, I mean, to speak to it, you know, obviously it's an ad from the early 60s. And it was important for me to put that in because, one, it was a very uncomfortable ad.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if to look at a professional or an architect, you know, drinking and one of these dirty little secrets about architecture, you can't do good architecture without, you know, a fifth on your desk, you know. You just can't.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to see, but you can't talk about that, right? You know, I used to have a fellow who was a dean at Princeton for a number of years. He used to empty his Coke can out, fill it up with whiskey, and he'd go to class in the Coke, you know. But anyhow, it's natural in the sort of behind the scenes.
Yeah.
But here it is in all its glory in a public advertisement. And so I said, wow. The other aspect of that, too, in the early 1990s, the AIA actually had a provision in its code. It was the 92 code, which got quickly taken off. But it actually said an architect couldn't drink or be physically challenged. And it did not last. It got on thinking basically to prevent architects from drinking and somehow, I don't know, you fall down on your desk and all of a sudden the project's not good. I don't know. But it had that other provision in it.
Well, and physically challenged, why on earth?
I have no, or mentally disabled.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
I think, you know, I think the intent behind the provision was that if something happened to a principal in a firm, they wouldn't still be seen as running things.
Yeah.
And it ties back. There used to be an injunction in the AMA code about physical deformity, about not being part and parcel of what a doctor could be ethically.
Yeah.
So it's very, very uncomfortable, obviously.
Yeah.
And it's, I'm sure, 99.999999% of architects and the AIA itself does not know about this provision or how quickly it was off the books, nor would they allow it if they saw it. I say this because I am a member of the AIA and I believe in them, and that's why I want to stay that way. But I mention it, though, because it came off the board. So that's an uncomfortable ad to focus about, well, this is a critical moment. And this leads into the next point, too, and I'll let you move on, but the next ad that you were going to refer to.
Well, the next ad is the Liebeskind ad, where David Liebeskind is, I'm not sure where it was taken from. You can't really tell from the ad itself, but he's in a big box. Basically, he's wearing a box like a Halloween costume almost, and it was an interesting ad, I thought, and people noticed it.
Well, it's a very striking ad, you know. When Daniel Liebeskind came to New York, if you remember, there was a lot of discussion in the popular papers about his dress, about the eyeglasses, about the publicity, but all these secondary things, you know, about how Daniel Liebeskind was coming back to New York.
Yeah.
And it was odd to me, and it was actually very touching because I, like probably a lot of people in the area, I was, you know, in Manhattan that day.
Yeah.
I went under the Trade Center in the subway that morning.
Yeah.
And looking at these ads, the ethics is still going in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're still lambasting the architect here, Daniel Liebeskind, for hiring a publicist, as opposed to what's the design going to be.
So he was criticized for this.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Oh, it was in all the local dailies, and you know, the New York dailies, I should say. And by the same token, the process, too, that happened afterwards, Liebeskind won that competition. Granted, the legalities of the competition, the bindingness of the competition, who knows? But it's problematic because there was an enormous process set up to engage the public and get them interested in New York design and rebuilding and taking part of the city.
Yeah.
It was all thrown out.
Yeah.
And so there has to be some kind of discussion in architectural ethics about architecture, about what good design is. And we've backed off from saying that as architects in the States. There aren't those kinds of legal fights over what an architecture should constitute. It always falls back in plurality. There's legal precedent set for this. There was a Supreme Court case in the 1940s saying that the Supreme Court or the federal government or any level of government won't dictate to the public what design should be. So Congress has jurisdiction ultimately. The people have jurisdiction over what good design is. But what it's done to architecture, though, is that you don't talk about architectural qualities, aspects, as an architect in your ethics in the public forums, or ethics being translated into the morals of the guidelines. Mm-hmm. It always falls back into the non-architectural, like publicity. If there's a driving force in this that I always have to pull myself away from, because you can feel very passionate about these things, yeah. It's just that there has to be some discussion over architecture if there's going to be an architectural profession. It's architecture, whether that's a question of spaces, whether it's a question of engagement, you know, doing architecture, being an architect. It has to be at those levels rather than these other extraneous things that come to dominate.
The Libeskind ad, I wanted to say, was especially interesting because it's so self-referential, because he's dressed up essentially as something that's packaged. It made me think of early Christo in a way. I thought, you know, I don't know if people caught the joke there, well, you know, looking at it, because he looks like a building also in a way with a box. But there's another ad in the show that was very interesting that also has to do with the World Trade Center. It's a 1970s ad that depicts a model of the World Trade Center and focuses on the structural steel used in its construction. And looking at it now, in retrospect, you can't help feeling a twinge of poignancy.
It was one of those ads that I think, if I have a moment of cowardice, it was in thinking whether or not to put that in. And I decided to put it in there because it is such a sensitive ad. It's the point of the Trade Center that failed, in essence, because it wasn't fireproofed properly. You know, that truss system works fine like it is, but it wasn't fireproofed properly.
And in the ad, is it fireproofed or is there a cutaway?
There's a cutaway on it because it's just to show the steel.
Yeah, yeah.
It's just to show the steel. And again, here, now, those buildings would have come down no matter what. Everyone knows that. It's just there's certain things are inevitable. You know, architecturally, you can't design security. You simply can't. But anyhow, but the buildings did come down. But this was the point where they did. And it's a point in this ad that is promoting Yamasaki as being the designer for the Trade Center. And it's focused in on this one poignant little spot that, because of the fireproofing, definitely time was lost, you know, that would have been there. No discussion is going to come out now because this is 30 years on. But it was a decision. Control was out of the hands of the architect in that case. And
was this value engineer somewhere?
Value engineered. Yeah, it's value engineered out. So, but that ad, putting that next to the Libeskind as well, I thought was important because it highlighted the importance of ethics in all of this. As much as, you know, I can almost look at this and say, oh, well, if there's a hero, you know, you want to be the Nietzsche of architectural studies, right? You know, doing the, you know, the genealogy of professional morals, right? But it's not to say that what we ought to be doing isn't important. It's just to say we have to cut out all these extraneous things that come in and really minimize the ethics that are necessary, because more actually gets in the way. And that comparison between the boxed Libeskind, who can't do what he needs to do because he's boxed, and, you know, this failed detail through value engineering, you know, there has to be some kind of critical and open thought, rather than, you know, attack the way it normally goes.
Ah, interesting. So I'd like to thank you, James, for visiting with us on the Library Cafe today to talk about your exhibit, Suspension of Disbelief, Advertising, and Architectural Ethics, on view in the Vassar College Art Library through November 30th.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the opportunity.
Yeah, it's been a lot of fun and very interesting. If you tuned in late to this discussion, you can find a podcast of it at our site at library-cafe.org, as well as a listing of future episodes. You've been listening to the Library Cafe on WVKR 91.3 FM, Poughkeepsie. I'm Thomas Hill.
50 years ago, Brown versus Board of Education outlawed segregated schools, promising the American dream to everyone. The dream of Brown is quality education for all children. But in poor schools, many children are being left behind without the math, science, and technology skills they will need to compete in today's world. How will you realize the dream? Volunteer. Mentor children. Demand accountability from schools and politicians. Learn more at realizethedream.org.